18, I wanted to go to Kathmandu. So those days, you could get a bus, double-decker bus. I think it's called the Magic Bus. You get one in London. And you travel for about 110 days, and you drive overland, so all through Afghanistan, Pakistan, Persia. In those days, it was Persia. So the world has really changed, hasn't it? So you drive all the way to Kathmandu. And those days, on this converted double-decker bus, so those days I had enough money to get there and I had enough money to get back. So I said to my parents, I want to go to Kathmandu, and they said, please go to university first. So I went to university, I had 4 years, including 1 year in Germany, Tübingen and Vienna, studying and travelling around Europe. In those days we had the East Europe, and you know, Europe was divided. So again, the world has changed a lot. And then when I was coming to my family here at university, there was the Falklands War, so the country went to war. And I felt very disillusioned to be in a country that was at war. That didn't fit with me. And the way the war was being treated to me, it was more like a football match, you know. So I decided that I would. It was time for me to go. So I bought a one-way ticket to Delhi, and I put a little knapsack on my back, and I left. I left home. So I often say that when I was at school, we had a little area with careers advice, and they advised you to become journalists or teachers or doctors or nurses, but nobody ever recommended that I become a Buddhist nun. When I went to university, there were many people who were paid to advise you to get a job, and again, nobody ever recommended that I become a Buddhist nun. So, and when I packed up and I left for Delhi, I had absolutely no intention of doing anything spiritual. But a month later, I was doing a course on Buddhism, and it made sense to me.
Okay.
I remember when I first came to the monastery, I often tell this story. When I first walked up to the monastery in Kathmandu, Kapan, Gomba, this is over 30 years ago when the Kathmandu Valley was still rice fields, paddy fields, and now it's all developed. It's all grown up. Those days you walked over the fields and you kept asking where the monastery was, and they point to a hill and you keep on walking. And when I first arrived there, I was with a friend, and he went to sign up to do the course. He decided he wanted to be a Buddhist monk. He actually never became a Buddhist monk. I became a Buddhist nun. And I sat outside, and the first thing I saw when I walked into the monastery was this Buddhist nun, and she had a cup of coffee in one hand and a piece of cake in the other hand. And she was sitting there, and my first thought was, oh, so they have nuns. Because I had no idea there was such a thing as a Buddhist nun. You know, we hear about Buddhist monks, but we don't hear about nuns, do we? And then I thought, well, if that's what it's like being a Buddhist nun, that's what I want to do with my life. Of course, my life hasn't exactly been drinking coffee and eating cake, but still.
Yeah, I think we have not really a good idea in Europe what means to be a Buddhist nun.
Right.
Can you tell me what are the rules? What was your experience? What is allowed to do? What is not allowed for you?
Oh, well, you know, we have vows that we take for life. I mean, the monastic vows, they're the same as the monk's vows. At least the novice vows, same as the novice monk's vows. But the motivation, actually, from the point of view of the monastic vows, is achieving liberation oneself, individual liberation, pratimoksha, individual liberation. In the Mahayana tradition, which Tibetan Buddhism is Mahayana, it's a universal vehicle. So it's seeking enlightenment. The motivation is not individual liberation, the motivation is to achieve enlightenment. So it's a choice if you want to live a celibate life and completely devote yourself to teachings, or if you want to live a lay life. That's a choice, it's individual choice. And then if you choose that way, then when you take these individual liberation vows, then you take them with a Mahayana motivation. That means you become a monk or nun with the wish to be able to devote yourself more fully to the practice, so you can achieve enlightenment, you can be of service. I mean, in my case, really, the reason I wanted to take ordination was I felt that this is what I wanted to do with my life, and very much I wanted to make sure that my teacher, Namasopa Rinpoche, that his teachings were made available. I wanted to help Rinpoche to bring his teachings to more people because I found them so beneficial in my life. As to what it means to be Buddhist monk or nun, it can take so many forms because there are so many different kinds of people. Everyone has a different mentality. For some people it means studying intensively. Some people learn Tibetan, they speak fluent Tibetan, they go to the monasteries and they debate, they spend years studying philosophy in depth. Some people study in English. We have monasteries in France, a very good monastery in France. We have monastic institutions in Australia and around the world. For some people it means working, for some people it means studying, for some people it means teaching, for some people it means drawing, for some people it means cooking, you know, it can be anything.
Okay.
So you have many paths. You have devotional paths, paths of service, paths of study, paths of teaching. It depends on the individual and their particular intonation. But the general idea is that you have less distraction. Because you don't have the concerns of family life, you don't have the concerns of working the family life. You know, once you have a family, then you have to support the family, obviously. You're in a relationship, then support the family, then you're going to need somewhere to live, you're going to need a phone, you're going to need a job, you're going to need a computer, you need clothes, you're going to need... I was thinking to myself the other day that over the 27 or 28 years that I've been a nun, I wonder how much money I've saved on clothes and cosmetics. I think it must be thousands of dollars. This thought came to me. It must be thousands and thousands of dollars, doesn't it? Because I know it's a lot of money in the West, especially if you have a job and you have to you have a certain lifestyle that you have to keep up with. Thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So I mean, one set of robes will last me quite a few years. Basically, they're teaching about your own mind, about your life. They're teaching the Buddha's psychology is very deep, very profound. But at the same time, I think it can easily be grasped. So when we do these 10-day courses, generally I start off and I explain a little bit the first couple of days, just Buddhist psychology. Why do we get angry? What kind of emotions produce happiness? What kind of emotions produce suffering? We talk about how to generate loving kindness, compassion, not in a limited way, but to train ourselves so that mind to become unlimited. We talk about attachment, and I challenge people to think a little bit about attachment and whether it really brings happiness, or whether when they look more closely they can see that attachment can actually be a painful mind that tortures us because we cling to the object, we get stuck on the object, we get dependent, we have expectations. Rather than being complete in and of ourselves, we start looking for something outside to make ourselves happy. And that mind that's constantly looking outside, of course, is an unhappy mind. And people can immediately relate to it and understand it. I don't think this is difficult. So even from the very beginning, I think you can get a clear understanding. In Buddhism, we explain why we get angry. Two reasons why we ever get angry, right? Somebody does something we don't want. They don't do something we do want. We get angry. And it's all focused around me. And the world should do everything that I want. You know, the world is there for me, to make me happy. So this kind of sense of entitlement we have. Particularly in the West, we have a huge sense of entitlement. And it's very interesting, when you examine this mind, it produces dissatisfaction. Constant dissatisfaction. Whereas just with a simple movement of the mind to appreciation, how much I have in my life, how much others do, how precious others are, how important others are. I mean, this is just moving the mind. This is not difficult. And suddenly things change and you have more joy. So it's very interesting. These are just learning how to think differently. It can make a huge difference. And then, of course, as you go along in the spiritual path, you go deeper and deeper into all the mechanisms of the mind that cause suffering, and you start trying to unpack the whole thing and learn how to develop mechanisms that reduce suffering instead. So I think this is this is very valuable. It's very challenging. It's not at all boring. It's quite dynamic. You're always learning more about your mind. And of course, if you get into a relationship with a guru, whose job is to challenge your ego and your self-cherishing all the time, it gets even more dynamic and even more challenging. So it makes life really quite exciting.
Yeah.
So I enjoy sharing this with others. And I think most people at the end of the course, you know, we do these courses, our goal is not to make people Buddhist. Our goal is just to introduce a different worldview and allow people to find out what their own worldview is. So I think at the end of your course, there was somebody who came to me and he was really very moved. He'd been reading a book about the dialogue between Buddhism and other religions, and he came from Israel, and he read the section on Judaism and had this profound realization that from his heart he was Jewish. And just tears came, and he suddenly reconnected with his own faith. And he came to tell me that, and I was extremely happy. The course before, there was a rabbi who came undercover, and at the end of the course he came up and he thanked me and he said, "You just proved to me the universality of truth which exists in all religions." And similarly, you know, I have people come and they say to me, "Well, you didn't manage to persuade me to become a Buddhist, but you did persuade me to lead a better life." You know, so secular ethics, some more understanding about the kindness of others, not harming others, in a secular way, which I think is success, you know.
Yeah.
Usually at the beginning of the course, I introduce this idea that some people think Buddhism is a philosophy, for some people it's a religion, for some people it's psychology, for some people it's a science of mind. You know, we have one very highly qualified Western Geshe, who's female actually, down in McLeodgan. She was teaching a 10-day course on the mind and mental factors. Oh, 13 days, it's a very big subject, very vast subject. She studied for years and years and years in the Tibetan monastery, monastic system, studied, debated, she has deep knowledge. She said for her, Buddhism is a science of mind. That's the conclusion she's come to after about 20, 30 years. And I generally say for myself, when I approach Buddhism, I approach it as a spiritual path. To me, it's a spiritual path. And then if somebody says to me, "Well, what's the difference between a religion and a spiritual path?" I usually explain that religion can be something that we believe without necessarily having any supportive reasons, and it doesn't necessarily transform us. In fact, religion, as we know, can make us more narrow-minded, can make us more attached to our own group, whereas a spiritual path is something that is transformative. Your goal is to transform your mind, your goal is to become a better human being. Your goal, if you practice the spiritual path, as I see it, you become more open-minded. You become more aware of the universality of basic values like kindness, compassion, sincerity, wisdom. Yeah, these basic human, good human qualities. So spiritual path is something that transforms the mind, it makes you into a better human being. That's what I feel. So I approach Buddhism as something from that perspective. Yeah?
Good time.
I think what we've seen actually since Buddhism came to the West is now we're seeing many more women at Dharma centers or Buddhist centers. Whereas, you know, if I compare this with Mongolia, in Mongolia, you know, I would be one of only a handful of nuns and all monks. So it's changing quite enormously because now we have more women, we have more female teachers, and in fact now we have very qualified female teachers who've actually taken a Geshe degree and have all the full qualifications. This is something very much that Westerners have been pushing for, equality. Westerners have been pushing for equality. Tibetan nuns traditionally were very quiet. They were very withdrawn. I think this is probably part of the culture. And that's now changing. Now we have several nunneries where the nuns are doing exactly the same study curriculum as the monks, and they're taking the same examinations. And I think the next 20 years is going to be even more of a radical transformation. The Tibetan Buddhism actually has changed enormously since the Tibetans left, came into exile, and with contact with the outside world. So you'll find that there are many Western female teachers in Buddhism, many of them. Whereas within Tibetan Buddhism, you don't find that many. They are there, but you don't find that many at the moment. But I would predict in the next 10, 20 years, there'll be more and more and more. And it just takes, they just need role models, really, and then it'll take off. So His Holiness has said many times that, yes, if it's more beneficial to come back in a female body, he'll come back in a female body. He said that. But he's also said that if he comes back in a female body, he's going to be very attractive, very beautiful, very charming. We have one female teacher in our organization who's Tibetan. She's actually very highly realized. And she's young, but she's very highly realized. And she teaches more from her realization, I think, than from study basis. She's very close to Nitai Lama and also very close to many other lamas. And that has been extremely helpful in giving us as Westerners role models. So we can see what a female teacher really is like. And she, of course, always appears extremely humble and very, very gracious, very humble. So it's an interesting model. On the one hand, you need to be strong and confident in order to, you know, take on this new role as a woman and teach. But on the other hand, very humble, very respectful.